All right, another episode. Welcome everyone to the show once again. We have brought Pete back to the show, this time to cover, since he's a man of many talents, this time to cover a little bit more about shares, because the last episode that we recorded was all about property. Date today of the recording is 14th May. Pete, welcome to the show once again, man.
Cheers, Jazz. Great to be back.
The number of talents that you have, I think I'll have to keep bringing you back. And the next one is going to be coaching, I guess.
They certainly don't include homeschooling, I can tell you that.
we just discussed that. We both are in the same boat on that one. maybe that should be the next one on the list. How are you going with the coronavirus?
Well, we're based up at Noosa, so there was a cluster here very early on. It's about 24 cases in a restaurant, but everybody dispersed, obviously being a tourist location. They all went back to where they'd come from, and I don't think we've had a case on the Sunshine Coast for 5 or 6 weeks now. So fingers crossed we're near the end now and come out of it relatively unscathed.
Yeah, I think Australia's honestly done a pretty good job, and the leadership has done a pretty decent job on that too by implementing a lot of things at very early stage, especially all the job keeper, job seeker, and the mortgage suspensions. That helped quite a lot. Otherwise, we could have seen it go really bad. Stock market was probably the example of that, actually, of what could have happened. So tell us a little bit, Pete. We discussed in the last episode, and just remind me, you started in, how long you have been in the property space now for?
I guess our first property purchase was back in the mid-1990s. I've been self-employed for the past 10 years with a real estate business. So it's been quite a journey. And as you said, we've not just done property, we've done stocks and self-development and other things along the way in terms of business. So I've always tried to take a view that it's good to have a balance. You don't need to be all or nothing on real estate, and the same applies to stocks.
Did you actually find that when people initially get started on either property or shares, whichever way they go first, that they are all in on one thing, then the other, and then slowly as you mature as an investor, you realize, you know what, and you see things like what we are seeing currently where things can change drastically, that being diversified is really a good thing, and you learn that over the time, and that's when you start moving into other directions?
Yeah, totally, because every asset class has market cycles and mean reversion, so it does make logical sense that at different times in your life, you would be potentially interested in different areas. And as you said, ideally, what you want is uncorrelated assets, so as diversified as you can be. Now, obviously, in a global recession, to a certain extent, all asset classes might be hit except for cash. But, I guess the point is that you don't have to have all of your eggs in one basket.
But here's the question for you. You have been in share market for a long time, and we'll discuss that in a minute. But do you really think the correlation part, that it's not correlated to the rest of the economy, which is real estate and some of the other sectors? I find it is that, especially the ASX, with the, if you look at the 40% of the ASX is probably banks, right? So, and the banks are real estate because their main source of income is mortgages, right? So are they really non-correlated? To me, it's, there's a lot of correlation in this space.
I think interesting thing, I mean, when I was growing up, they used to have this saying, if Uncle Sam sneezes, the rest of the world catches a cold. And that, for Australia, still holds true. I think to a certain extent, obviously, China is our main trading partner these days. But if you actually look at it these days, the world is becoming more and more globalized and correlated. And if you look at the performance of global stock markets, the number one influence is essentially what happens to the US stock market being half of the global market cap. And so Q4 2018, really good example, US market tanked 20%, everywhere else followed. And then in Q1 of the following year, the US bounced back, everywhere else followed. So to a certain extent these days, stock markets largely reflect what's happening in America. And in fact, if you look at the global equities ETF. It's just a mirror image of what's happening in America. It just follows the same pattern. And a really good example in Australia, 2007 to 2009, we didn't even have a technical recession. We didn't have a housing bubble, didn't have any major issues like the US did, but it didn't stop our stock market effectively halving because America did. So you're right, the correlation is, if anything, is higher than ever, but it's not with necessarily the domestic economy even. It's very much a reflection of what's happening in America these days.
Spot on that the recovery that just happened after the 40% or 38% drop, it was mirror image of what happened in the US stock market, right? And whatever happens, it's probably a really good leading indicator if you want to look at what's going to happen here if you follow that market closely, because our systems or the processes are built in a fairly similar fashion to that part of the Western world, I think.
Yeah, totally. So one of the key metrics that is worth following is the US CAPE ratio. A bit of jargon there, apologies, but what the CAPE ratio tries to do is it understands that company earnings are up and down through the years, through the cycle. So what it does, it takes a smooth 10-year average for earnings and then looks at what price have people been prepared to pay. So the US CAPE ratio was as high as 33.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, it was a bit higher than that. So what that tells you is two things. Firstly, the expected returns for US stocks over the coming 10 years are very low, in real terms, almost nothing, essentially. But it also tells you that the risk is high. And so that's why what we were saying to people in our coaching programs last year is that we can't predict what's the grain of sand that's going to tip this over. But historically, the CAPE ratio has never been sustained at 33 before. It's been higher, it went higher during the tech bubble, yep. But it's never stayed up there. So it's a really good starting point when you're thinking about risk. Now, of course, there are some arguments that, yes, we've got low interest rates, there's QE, and therefore maybe the CAPE ratio these days will be higher than it used to be, because the long-term average is only 17. But still, even today, it's at 26. So yep. You could say, well, yes, it's come down from 33, but there's still potentially quite a lot of downside risk from there.
How do you go much into the charts at all of the S&P 500 to look at the moving averages and all, or you don't look at that stuff, the moving averages, like the weekly moving average and the monthly moving averages? Because I was looking at the chart only last night and the weekly chart, and it got perfectly rejected at 0.61, and it seems like that it's gonna, if it's got rejected from there, that it's gonna most likely drop.
Yeah, so it's a really good question. So the way I think about investing is I think of it in three different time frames. So for a long-term and legacy investment, so something I'm literally going to buy and put in the bottom drawer, which might be, for example, a consumer staple or a telco or an oil company, for something like that, where you're really only looking at the fundamentals, and if the dividend yield is, let's say, 7 or 8% and you bought at a really cheap price, you're not really interested in the day-to-day moving averages. It's kind of irrelevant because you're just buying for the income streams between now and doomsday.
Yep.
Where things like moving averages come into the picture is if you're managing a short-term pot of money, so for example, to cover your living costs over the next 12 months, then that's where the moving average becomes more important. And now, I think people can get too far down the rabbit hole when it comes to technical analysis, but there's one really important thing to remember, and that's what you already touched on, and that is when stock markets fall below their 200-day moving average, suddenly the volatility spikes. So that's a dangerous period then, especially if you're using a leveraged ETF or something of that nature.
Yeah.
So there are different ways to manage your short-term pot of money. The way I do it is I use leveraged ETFs, but when the market's below its 200-day moving average, you're better off just saying, look, this is way too volatile, because what we know is that leveraged ETFs get hurt by volatility, and we know that volatility spikes as soon as markets start falling. It's human nature, right? We all panic when the market goes down.
I personally think that the stock market right now is completely ignoring the reality of what's happening in the economy. What are your thoughts on this whole ignoring the reality and just being in its own space now?
Yeah, so I guess when I'm thinking in terms of asset allocation and how much of my money do I want exposed to stocks and how much do I have in cash, the first place I look, and I try to focus on statistics over stories, the first place is the US CAPE ratio, and that says, look, it's not as expensive as it was, but by the time this year's earnings are flushed through, it's still pretty damn expensive given the parlous state of the economy. So that's the first place I would look. But in terms of these bounces and rebounds, I mean, if you look at every bear market, you will always find that you get these dead cat bounces. So, for example, 2000 to 2003, we saw big drops, then a snapback, big drops, then a snapback. It happens in every bear market, same in the financial crisis and same in every bear market. So they're kind of inevitable. Maybe algorithmic trading has made the rebounds sharper. Yeah. I think to a certain extent as well, don't forget we had the fastest drawdown in history. So if markets are asymmetric, then yeah, potentially the fastest drawdown would get the fastest bounce. But I think in terms of why the market is so expensive, well, there's two things really. One is liquidity. So the Fed has just been pumping in the stimulus like there's no tomorrow. And secondly, stock markets are arguably supposedly forward-looking. So you could make the case that people are saying, well, look, in 2 years' time, the coronavirus will have gone and therefore we can justify today's valuations. I would say I would just start with the CAPE ratio and say, well, I've just got a basically a ratchet system and it says, look, if the CAPE's at 26, I need to be pretty careful because there's a good chance, if you look at history, that the CAPE could fall to 20 or 15 or even in some cycles as low as 10 or 8. So you need to be a bit careful when the CAPE is so high about exposing too much to stocks. Yeah.
I think you hit the nail on the head. It's the liquidity is the main reason that the market has been going up. By mandate, the Fed is not allowed to purchase stocks, but there's other ways to get around it. And that's what's happening by injecting all this money into the economy, which is pumping up the market to some extent. So how did you finally got started in this space, mate? So how long have you been in the share market now for?
So I actually started out in stocks rather than property. Obviously, it's a lower barrier to entry. My profession was as a chartered accountant. So when I was working in professional practice, I used to audit listed company financials. Then later, when I left my director role and went into industry, as a group FC, my role was actually to produce financial statements. So intuitively, what I felt was, well, surely, given my skill set, you know, financial reporting standards, international standards, disclosures and notes, my point of difference should be understanding financials. I guess so that's where I started out as a value investor in inverted commas. I think what I learned in time is that there's a lot more to valuing a business than looking at the previous year's financials, because obviously that is all historic information. And a lot can change in terms of the competitive environment, demand growth, cost of labour. You know, there's so many variables in valuing a company, so you need to paint with a fairly broad brush. So that's how I got started out. My wife and I have also got some index funds that we set up essentially for our kids, and they've been running now for about 20 years or so. There's nothing flash about those. We just put in the same amount every month, and it just dollar cost averages, so there's no favoritism between the kids, they just get exactly the same. So I mean, that's what you would call the dumb money in inverted commas. It doesn't try to be too clever, and look, it's had its ups and downs over the years, but it's performed reasonably well over that period. And so I guess that's where my interest developed from. But over time I learned that value investing, you can spend far too much time sometimes analyzing numbers. And actually, you need to take a step back and look at the macro picture first.
Yeah. So you basically have been a number man from the day one, being a chartered accountant. So you understand how to read the financial statements, right? But for the people who are not number savvy or don't know how exactly to read the balance sheets and all, right? How would you go about investing in the share market, especially in the current environment?
Yeah, so I think the first thing is don't, if you're not going to analyze businesses, don't kid yourself and pretend that you're going to do it, because one of the classic things in investing is you decide you like to invest in such and such a company, you buy a load of shares, and then you go away and read a few annual reports to, you know, make yourself feel good, you know, kind of an exercise in confirmation bias. So if you're not going to do the analysis, you don't have to these days. And one of the great things that's really changed, you don't need to phone up a stockbroker and say, can you buy me shares in a specific company? You can very easily buy the entire index. You can buy a listed investment company that might own, say, 100 or 120 stocks. And you can get very solid returns by doing that. So if you don't know anything and you're not going to go to the extent of analyzing a company, that's not necessarily a bad thing. You can just accept that you don't need to be a stock picker, and you can simply buy a diversified basket of companies. I would still say you don't want to pay too much for them, of course, but it's obviously a lot less risky. And it's one of the 8 key principles that we cover in our book, the 8 timeless principles, is the risk hierarchy. Because if you invest in an individual company, there's always a risk that there's a fraud or the company falls on hard times and it goes to zero. And of course, if you go to zero, you're never making your money back. Whereas if you buy, for example, an ETF that owns a whole index, obviously there's no risk of 300 companies going bust. So it's a lot less risky because it can't go to zero.
Yeah. Warren Buffett, everyone knows him, obviously, right? So it's probably not the, we're not dealing at that level, but he's been in the news lately with all his cash sitting in the sidelines. He's still not investing in the stock market. He's in fact, ended up selling his all his airline stocks, right? The news was out a couple of days ago, which makes sense. We fully get why he did that. When the smart money is sitting on sidelines, that starts to make you think, is now the right time to be really looking at the stock market? Like we were discussing before, it looks like it's still in the bear market phase where it's going to drop further. Even though if you're a long-term investor, long-term being here 5 to 10 years, right? How would you now go about investing in the market? Will you wait or will you start doing dollar cost averaging because you don't know whether it's going to drop because of all the money that is being printed, how that's going to play out?
Yeah, so I think this is where you need to take into account your own personal circumstances and tolerance for risk and experience and so on. Personally, what I do is I look at the CAPE and I say, right, 26, that tells me I shouldn't be heavily invested in stocks. So it's not an all or nothing equation. You don't go, right, today I'm 0% and tomorrow I'm going 100. It's more of a counterbalance where I would essentially look to be, if the market is very cheap, I would want to be 80% in stocks and 20% in cash. And last year, obviously, the market at unsustainably high levels, so very much tilted towards, say, 20% in stocks and 80% in cash. Yeah. So you have to develop your own view on these things. That's the way I look at it. If you're not sure, what the dollar cost averaging approach does is that it obviously smooths your entry price. So if you're not familiar with the term, it basically holds that you put in, say, $1,000 a month, January, February, March, April, and if the market goes down, you buy more effectively, and if the market goes up, then you buy fewer units, essentially. So it has this natural smoothing effect. Yeah. But obviously the downside of dollar cost averaging is that you'll never do better than the average, because by definition, you're not really trying to.
Yeah. Dollar cost averaging in a bear market it just doesn't work. I don't think it's a great strategy personally, but what are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, my view is a little different from when I started out. The thing that's really changed these days, and you can drive yourself mad looking at the stock market day to day, you know, why is it going up? The economy's in the toilet, you know, or why is it falling? The economy seems to be improving. The thing that's really changed since I started is that these days you don't have to have the home bias. So Australia has potentially about, say, 2-3% of the global market cap. So we're only, relatively speaking, a small market. But investors, naturally, they're much more inclined to invest at home. So investors might have, say, 70% of their investments in Australian shares, even though we're only a tiny portion of the world. So I would say if Australian stocks fall to half price and, you know, they've collapsed from their highs, then go for your life. Why wouldn't you invest in the market at home? But the thing to remember is that these days there's a whole big world out there and you don't have to focus only on Australian stocks. So, and if you take a global view, so look at a website like, say, Novel Investor or something like that, you'll see that every year there are markets that become cheap. So developed markets, emerging markets, sectors, styles. You can invest in almost anything these days. So you don't have to have that very narrow focus just on the Australian market. Yep. Because you live in Australia. There are products now, ETFs, that allow you to invest globally without having to take on company-specific risk. So that's what I would do, is just don't get too panicked about missing the bottom. Just take a more considered approach, because there will always be good opportunities in the future.
If you want to individually start investing in certain sectors, right, how do you go about identifying them? Which one to pick? What are you looking at?
Yeah, so what I do is I start with what's called the quilt of returns. So that shows you, so let's say we're doing sectors. You'd look at the returns by sector each year. And what you invariably find, and this is why I say focus on statistics, not stories, is that the sectors that have been the worst performers in recent years then become the best performers, and the ones that become too expensive eventually fall back. So looking at it year to year, it might appear to be random, but what you really need to do is, if you actually look at it on the basis that the worst performers subsequently become the best, then why wouldn't you buy in the cheapest sector? So for five of the past 6 years, the worst performing sector has included energy. So energy has been an absolutely hated sector now for 5 or 6 years. It was partly because of ESG investing and the movement towards ethical, sustainable investing. But more recently, the oil prices collapsed. There's massive oversupply, you know, Saudis and Russians having an oil price war. So, of course, the energy sector is now very cheap. So going back to the risk hierarchy, though, if you pick an individual company in an oil price war, there's always that nagging doubt that even a big company could go bust. So the much lower risk approach, and this isn't advice, it's just this is what I'm doing, is to say, well, OK, I'll just look at the whole energy sector, and you could buy, say, the biggest 130 companies in the world. So Chevron, ExxonMobil, Schlumberger, Occidental Oil, BP, Shell. You know, there's absolutely zero risk of those companies all going to the wall. Some of the smaller ones will drop out. Now, obviously, it feels quite counterintuitive when everybody's saying this is the end of the world for oil. But of course, that's when everyone else has sold out. The index has fallen by more than half pretty quickly. So you can buy a share in all of these great companies for a fraction of the price. Other sectors that have been out of favour, telcos have been relatively cheap. So it's not hard now if you take a global approach. You could look at, if you combine a cheap sector with a cheap country, so, you know, Turkey, South Korea, you can pick up telcos there that are throwing off enormous income streams because everybody else has gone out. So that's where I would start. It's look at the most out of favour sectors and most out of favour countries. Because if you looked at, say, for example, energy, terrible 6 years, but the 6 years before that, great performance. So it's just those patterns repeating.
Yeah, so it's cyclical, basically.
It repeats here too. You know, look at Australia. So dreadful time through the global financial crisis. Market fell basically 50% through to March 2009. Mm-hmm. But then if you look at the returns from that point over the coming year, you know, depending on which ETF you picked, you might have made 70, 80% returns. So don't start with what's popular. Start with what's cheap and hated.
Yeah. What do you think about the banking sector in Australia? Whatever the bottom of the market is, no one knows, right? But if it was to drop further or where it is currently, do you think the banking sector is going to be a good buy, or they've run out of steam finally?
I think over the long run, potentially, I mean, the main headwind for Australian banks and the financial sector is potentially just more regulation. Like, I'm always happy to hear the other side of an argument, by the way. I don't get wedded to these ideas. But obviously, they had a long tailwind for a long period of time. But now with more regulation and more competition, see, the big four banks are now lowest market share in years and years. So potentially that is a challenge for the banks, and it's reflected in prices. You know, you look at some of the big banks, they're trading at the same prices they were at in the mid-1990s. Mm-hmm. And that's why one of the principles that we talk about is buying low and selling high, because, you know, you could have bought in 1996 and had tremendous returns from, you know, the big banks, and then you've basically given it all back in some cases. Yeah. On the index, obviously the dividends have been strong. So take a profit. If you have a great investment, don't leave it all fully invested, because eventually you'll give it back.
Yeah. I was actually having a chat with Scott, who is the CIO of Motley Fool, the research company, and he made a pretty good point, and I kind of agreed with him on the banking sector. He goes, I'm not a bear and I'm not a bull either on that particular sector, purely because they heavily rely on income from mortgages, right? And if you look at the mortgage industry, it is not growing at the pace that it used to. And on top of that, the interest rates have already fallen to the point where there is no more room left to fire any bullets. So when you take all of that into account, how is the banking sector going to grow?
Yeah, totally agree. And that's why I say, why have the home bias? You know, if there was only one market in the world, and that was Australia, well, so be it. You have to, you know, take your pick from that index, but that's just not the case anymore. Yeah. Australia, since 2010, the index went up and then it came all the way back to where it started. So you've had a pretty underwhelming 10 years. And, you know, people make a lot of, you know, they cherry pick data points, and I've just done it myself. But yeah. I suppose the one thing Australia potentially has in its favour is that the CAPE ratio for Australia is not too expensive now. Mm-hmm. So that's one good thing. We've had a pretty underwhelming 10 years. The next decade might be better. But also resources have had a terrible time. And potentially China stimulus infrastructure projects, potentially countries like Australia and Brazil could benefit from that over the coming decade. But I wouldn't put 100% of my money into that idea. I'd, you know, maybe have 10%. You know, it's just, there's no need to put all of your eggs in one basket these days. It's much easier to take a global view.
What do you think about the gold mining stocks? I was looking at personally some of the charts. Gold has obviously been shooting up in the current market, and it makes sense. Gold has always played as a hedge against the against these kind of events when they occur, right? And the mining stocks are obviously going. I have shot up a fair bit. Perthmint is probably one of the examples. What do you think in the next few years? Are they going to be a good buy?
Possibly. I think the sector it's had a rough run for quite a long period of time, and that's normally a good sign. I think the thing to remember in Australia, when I used to work in resources, is that we've got this whole raft of companies that just don't make any money at all. Exploration companies, some of the more speculative end of the market. So if you're going to invest in those companies, you can very realistically lose 100% of your capital. So if you're going to do resources, I would stick to the bigger end of town and potentially even an ETF. But potentially after a difficult period, I think energy and resources could have a better decade ahead. But, yeah, different outlook for different sectors. So iron ore has held up surprisingly well through this recession so far, but a lot will depend on China and its capacity to start building again.
Personally, looking at the gold price and some of the gold mining stocks, it feels like, and looking at the charts as well and overall macro environment that we are sitting in, it feels like it's not a bad time to be looking at that as a hedge against the inflation right now. If you think that the market is still going to tank, if it is, and if you're trying to bottom the market or be close to it, then it's probably a safe hedge while all this currency is being printed by all the central banks, the madness that's going on.
Yeah, I mean, that's outside my area of expertise. A couple of my friends, Jordan Alizio, who is the chief economist at ABC Bullion for many years, and a few of my Twitter followers and friends would know much more than I do about the prospects for gold. I understand the principle behind it. It's a relatively limited supply, and in times of fear, then people could very much go in more into gold. But there's never, not really a space I've got much experience of, except did used to work in the industry in a copper gold mining firm. But yeah, my experience of trying to prepare forecasts was that people come up with numbers and they prove to be wildly inaccurate. So
yeah, it's a hard one. Gold is a real hard one. How do you put a true number to it? People who are, who have got enough wealth sitting in their bank accounts, whether it's USD or Australian, whatever dollars they are, right? It's trying to preserve that somehow while all this currency is being manipulated or devalued, essentially. For the timing, it's obviously going up, but over the long run, it's being devalued. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, look, you would know more than me about these things, and I guess it's one of the nice things in the stock market is that you can keep it simple, and you don't need to be an expert in everything. You only need a few good simple ideas, buy them at the right price, and yeah, when the market gets expensive again, just rebalance, take a profit, and off you go again. Doesn't have to be overly complicated, and I think that's what I was alluding to back at the start. You can get down this rabbit hole of thinking that doing more and more analysis will help you, but often you know, it's like diminishing returns. You know, you get actually less and less value from the more analysis you do.
Yeah.
So yeah, I'd basically start with what looks cheap. You know, where can I pick up a bargain? And if I can stick with ETFs instead of companies, then obviously lower risk.
Yeah.
And yeah, just focus on principles rather than spending too much time on getting bogged down on trying to predict, you know, the iron ore price in 2023 or something. So you just can't do it.
Yeah. So what are some of the resources that you will tell the listeners who want to get started in this space or are trying to advance in this space? Books or videos or whatever it is, blogs that you would recommend reading while learning about this stuff?
Yeah, so check out our website because we've got a list of resources you can use there. So the website is lowrateshighreturns.com.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a few things there. So there's a free chapter of our book. There is some links to other websites that could be useful. Really good one I already mentioned is called Novel Investor. And that just shows you the quilt of returns by country. So emerging markets, developed markets, sectors, and styles. And so that's a really good starting point for thinking, screening for opportunities. On our website, we've got the list of our 8 principles. So, you know, timeless principles for investing. I think if you're going to invest globally, you might need to look at, as you mentioned, getting a different brokerage account because, like a lot of people, I've got a Big 4 Aussie bank brokerage account, but it's very narrow in terms of what you can and can't do.
Yeah.
And it's essentially a 10 a.m. to 4 p.m. operation as well, so you can't do a lot in real time in the international market. So I use a global brokerage, Interactive Brokers, but there are plenty of others.
Yeah.
So these days they're relatively cheap, and you can actually, then you've got a full universe of investments. You don't have to focus just on, you know, Aussie shares or a few listed investment companies.
Yeah.
So those are some really good starting points in terms of resources. And yeah, definitely check out our blog there because there's plenty of stuff on there that's all free.
Surely. No, that's really good. 3 tips for investors in the share market.
Yeah, so I think with stocks, I think you really need to understand your strategy. And so we call it systematic investing. I think if you go into investing in stocks with just a vague idea that, okay, well, I'm just going to go with a gut feel approach, what you'll find is, and it's like the first rule of engineering, if something can go wrong, eventually it will. And so what you find is then when the market tanks 39% in a few weeks like it did, it's very, very hard then if you haven't got a systematic plan to actually then to make it an emotion-free decision. You're bound to be panicked and emotional, and you'll stuff up, basically. You'll make a rational decision. So I guess the first thing is you've got to have a written plan, and it might take you some time to work out what system is appropriate for you. But if you don't have a system, then the alternative is just gut feel, and that will never work in stocks.
Yep.
Second thing to think about. Let's have a think. I think a good another thing to do even before you start is understand your personality type, because we've got a test that we take, and you can actually take it for free if you email us. It's an Enneagram assessment, because there are essentially 9 different personality types. And the main types are the type 3, which is the achiever, and type 7, which is the very much a freedom-focused personality type. And we do get some type 5s, which are sort of thinker analyzers. And what you'll find is that each of the different personality types will have very different views of the markets and how they react when markets are up and when they're down and through the cycles. So having an objective view of yourself is a really useful thing to do even before you start. You can either take our Enneagram assessment, or there are plenty of free ones online. And what we do for people is say, look, here's an investment map. And it's a, you know, if your personality type is type 3, you know, this is how you will view the market, and this is what you'll be feeling at various points in the cycle. Mm-hmm. And I suppose third tip, I think I already sort of touched on earlier. Now, I try to think of investing in different time frames. We call it the three wells. So you've got your short-term bucket of funds, which is for living costs over the next year or so. So cover your groceries, essentially, and your utilities. Then you've got this sort of long-term bucket, which might be superannuation, investment properties, or potentially the big sort of systemic companies that have been around for, you know, 50 or 100 years that you can just buy, stick it in the bottom drawer, and it just keeps on throwing off big income streams. And you might just look to rebalance those once a year. But then what often people are missing is that kind of that middle well or middle bucket, which covers your lifestyle costs from, say, 1 to 5 years. So car upgrades, school fees, holidays, that sort of thing. Yeah. And that's where you might look to take a sort of try to make money on an annual basis by buying sectors or countries when they're cheap. Because what the evidence shows is if a company or if a country or sector falls 50, 60, 70% over the coming years, you get these big returns on the rebound. Mm-hmm. And that's how you can make money on a sort of 1 to 5 year basis. So try and think about your money across those time frames and just understand what your strategy is across each.
Yeah, personality is the key one, for me at least, that once you know what your personality is, of what sort of an investor you are, how do you like to play in that space, that will help define a lot of things. And it makes things to some extent a little bit easier if you know what your personality is. Because there's day traders, there's people who trade on a yearly basis where they will just buy stocks and put them in the drawer, whatever it is, right? And then there's sector players who just play with the sectors completely. They know that their sector is going cyclical, it's going to move out, like you mentioned, the energy stocks before. Now, that's really good. If you were to look at the S&P 500, and I've got the chart open in front of me right now, currently sitting at, this is the weekly chart that I'm looking at, sitting at 2815. Playing with the 21-week moving average, heading downwards. So it's probably not going to sustain that. Pick a number where the market will bottom, or if it's already bottomed.
Yeah, I'm contradicting myself here, because you have to remember all of the expert predictions are garbage. You know, every year in the paper it says, right, the ASX starts the year at 7,000. Where do you think it'll finish? And they always say 8 to 10% higher, because that's the average. But, you know, within 5 or 6 weeks through the year, suddenly the market dropped nearly 40%. You know, it shows you predictions are basically meaningless. And that's why I say you've got to have a systematic approach that focuses on statistics, not stories. Yep. Well, if the CAPE's at 26, I think there's a good chance that it could bottom out this cycle at 15 to 20. So if you take that approach, well, that could be potentially a 25% fall from here. So you might see stocks heading back towards 2,000 for the S&P 500. But of course, the Fed is throwing the kitchen sink and everything else on the market, so I could easily be wrong.
Yeah, I am with you on that one, that it feels like it's going to be a double bottom here. It's going to go and retest the bottom, which is around that 2,100, 2,000 mark, if not lower. So we'll see. But this is not any kind of financial advice. Mate, anything else that you would like to cover from a listener's perspective who are trying to invest in this space, or we pretty much discussed it all?
Yeah, I think there's a few other things, other models that we use in our programs. One is called the three C's, why you should consider managing your own money. So that's cost, obviously fees, choice. These days, you don't have to have the home bias. You can invest in anything you like. And thirdly, control. Because if you just throw your money out to a fund manager, they take nothing of your own circumstances into account. So if you can learn to manage your own money, you benefit from those three C's. And I suppose the other thing is just a model that we use called the four F's. And so that's fun, fitness, finance, and philosophy. You know, stocks is only one part of your life, and you've got to have a balance of all four. So stocks can obviously help you to fund the lifestyle that you want, but you need to work out, well, where do you want to get to first, and then work it backwards from there. Because whenever somebody says to you, like, this is the only way to invest, you know that's garbage, because there are nine different personality types. We've all got different needs and wants and goals, so, and motivation. So there can't just be one way to invest logically. You've got to find something that works for you, as you already mentioned.
Yeah, well, you haven't jumped into the crypto market yet. That's going to be your next aim, I guess.
Not for me.
It's an interesting one. That's all I'll say. I've been looking at it. But no, that's really good, mate. Appreciate your time once again. I'm sure we'll talk soon again on some of the chapters. For our listeners, hope they are enjoying the content. And if you guys are, please don't forget to give us a 5-star rating on iTunes.